From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour as we move through the summer, through our warm July. It's a great, great summer and great, great weather that the good Lord has given us. A little bit hot for some of us on some days, but it's been pretty pleasant most of the time. Baseball, beer, and Bishop Soto. That's alliterative. We've got a lot of B's in there. Baseball, beer, and Bishop Soto. Saturday, July 28th, 4 o'clock at Raley Field in West Sacramento, 400 Ballpark Drive in West Sacramento. If you've never been to a River Cats game, if you've never been to Raley Field, it's a real treat. Beautiful ballpark. All young adults, 18 to 39, are invited for a special Q&A with Bishop Soto. You can enjoy a drink in the beer garden, make new friends, get to know the bishop. Of course, if you're under 21, you can't have the beer. But 18 to 39 is the general age here. And then watch the River Cats face the Iowa Cubs. Stay for the free fireworks after the game. It's all just $20. And they would just love to hear from you. Go to scd.org/baseball. And the schedule, the early entry is at 4 o'clock. And then 4:30 to 5:30 p.m., a Q&A with the bishop, and just a wonderful, wonderful event. 6 o'clock, public gates open, 7:05 p.m., the first pitch at Raley Field. Again, baseball, beer, and Bishop Soto, Saturday, July the 28th at Raley Field. Well, it's a wonderful event, the 50th anniversary, the celebration of the 50th anniversary of Umana Evita will take place in Ontario, near the end of the month, and we've been telling you a bit about this, but here to tell us a little bit more is Dr. Ray Guarendi, certainly no, not an unknown name to most of our listeners. Dr. Ray, good morning to you.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
Very, very good. Good to hear your voice again. It's been a while. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us. You are one of the keynote speakers at this great Umana Evita conference. Tell us just a little bit your take on Umana Evita and why that is so important today.
Immorality is illogical. When Paul VI came out with his logical conclusions to the pressure to alter the church's teaching, he basically came out and said, well, here's the logical outcome of all of this. Now, when you're blinded by ideology, you don't look at logic. He said certain things were going to happen to our society and the relations between men and women. Many intelligentsia scoffed. This is why you don't let a celibate old man into our bedroom, of course. Well, obviously, everybody knows he was prophetic. What he said would happen. The only way he missed it, Bob, I think, is he probably underestimated what was going to happen. So as a result, so much of what he said has decayed a society. There were a couple of guys, a couple of sociologists, who studied I forget how many different cultures, probably 40, 50 different cultures. They wanted to see what would happen to be at the root of the culture decline. Do you know what they concluded? An out-of-wedlock birth rate exceeding 25%. Now, how long have we been over 25%?
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. So, and they said this held across cultures. And as a psychologist, I can tell you why it holds. I mean, my office is full of people who basically have relationships of his, mine, ours, yours, whatever. And the ultimate victims are the kids, because you can't pass on the morals to then root and glue the society. So I think Humana Vitae is absolutely brilliant. The problem is, with all brilliance in our culture, and I think this is human history, with all brilliance, it's not accepted. It's too brilliant. it's out of the realm of typical sheep-like thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where we're at.
Yeah, in fact, you know, if people people finally look it up, nowadays it's easy to look up. It's easy to get your hold hands on it, and people go, wow, this is, not like you say, not only is it good stuff, but it's prophetic. It's like, how, wait a minute, did this guy have a vision or something?
It's logical, too.
Yeah.
Strip it of its morality. Strip it of the fact that this is a bunch of Christians. The people, all right, let's bring it to modern day. Now, last night, I know this is recorded, so I listened to Brett Kavanaugh in his little acceptance speech from President Trump.
Right, the new chief, the new justice, not chief justice, the new justice of the Supreme Court replacing Anthony Kennedy, a Sacramento,
well, we hope
no less.
So. We hope yeah. so, anyway.
Well, that's true. It still has to be confirmed. He still has to be confirmed by the Senate.
According to reports, he's a practicing Catholic.
Well, we know he at least coaches CYO basketball.
There you go. And he even said Blessed Sacrament School. I'm almost waiting for the gasp, you know. And then he talked about going to his Jesuit high school.
Right.
So I figure if that's not enough to shoot him down, I don't know what is.
And I think he talked about feeding the homeless. I'm not sure if it was with Bishop or with his parish priest, but
it is the guy that's the head of the Catholic services in the area.
Oh, that's right. It was Catholic Charities. That's right. That's right.
Now, in my office, if a parent comes in and I say to them, if you want to know how resistant your child is to a certain limit, a certain condition, a certain expectation, stand your ground. In other words, for example, if you want to know how absolutely attached, like a third kidney, this kid is to her cell phone, take it. Watch the reaction.
Yeah.
Well, in American culture, what you're seeing right now is the secular, and I don't call them progressive, I call them secular regressives, the secular regressives' reaction to the idea that somebody would even remotely be involved with limiting abortion. That's it. That is, for them, they're reacting crazily, because it's like taking the cell phone from the 14-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
You're threatening to take abortion from us. This is it. This is by far our sacrament. And I'm watching it, and I'm thinking, this is the parallel between parents in my office who are saying, if I do that to my child, she'll go crazy, and the moral structure of our society, which says, if you take that from us, we'll go crazy.
So here we are 50 years later, and there was at the time of Humanae Vitae, a belief, an expectation that Paul VI was just kind of going to rubber stamp all the, you know, the pill. This is a great medical advance for humankind. The church has basically been in favor of medical advances over the years. You know, we don't fight science and medicine. We join hands with them generally, and even among not necessarily his inner circle, but even among many Catholics, there was a belief that he was going to go along with this, and really, really shocked the world. But as you say, in a most prophetic way.
I left the Catholic Church for about 8 years. I was in the evangelical world. In the evangelical world, there is a belief among Catholics that really bothers non-Catholics, and that is that the Pope is protected by the Spirit himself from teaching error in matters of faith and morals. They don't like that at all. That flat out just is spiritual arrogance to the nth degree as they see it. Back at the time when Paul VI had consulted and prayed, he didn't know, and medical science didn't know, that the pill could be an abortifacient.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really know that.
Mm-hmm.
So what would have happened if he would have said, well, like all other Christian denominations and virtually all Christian independent churches, we're going to go in that direction, and we're going to say that abortion is a grave evil because it kills a living being. However, you can take this pill that in some small unknown percentage of cases also will kill a very, very early human being. Now, he didn't know that. The medical profession didn't know that. I think that was a classic example of God protecting his church. Because the moral incongruity of saying, on one hand, life begins at conception, but on the other hand, we give you something that can kill that life. You're permitted to take it. As a church, we allow it. Would have been unbelievable. It would have shaken me to my boots. It truly would have, because I was on my way back to the Catholic Church. And one of the reasons I so was attracted to the Catholic Church was her moral consistency. And that would have shook me up.
We're talking with Dr. Ray Guarendi, who is one of the featured speakers at the Humanae Vitae Conference, which will take place July. Well, it starts July 25th, runs through the 28th at the convention center in Ontario. Special rates offered by the DoubleTree by Hilton. Also speaking will be Professor Janet Smith, George Weigel, the great papal biographer, Christopher West, Archbishop Salvatore Corleone from the Archdiocese of San Francisco, Patrick Coffin, and a number of other great speakers, including our own Steve Patton from the Respect Life Ministry here in the Diocese of Sacramento. Dr. Ray, tell us, when you look back to that time, 1968, it was also the beginning to kick the door open on abortion, and none other, shockingly, now when you look back at it, than Governor Ronald Reagan of California signing one of the first bills in the United States to legalize abortion, something he came, according to his biographer, later in life to greatly regret. But at the time, it was one of those, it was kind of like what people expected Paul VI to do. Go along. This is an advance. This is freedom. This is whatever. That was all happening in the late 60s as well.
I see the fallout, Bob, in my office. The sexual confusion in terms of identity crises, the lives that are falling apart because of flamingly loose sexual practices, the percentage of children out of wedlock, now with their third quote-unquote live-in uncle. I see this. I see the door that was thrown open. I mean, it's always been there. Human beings have always gone against sexual morals. That's I understand that. But for a culture to then celebrate that kind of anything-goes morality can bring the culture down. All you have to do is sit in my office for a small period of time, and you will look at folks, whether they're religious or not, whose lives are unraveling. And so much of the time, you can trace it to the fact that they have either been unaware of the way God says is the best way to do it, or in defiance of the way God says is the best way to do it. But either way, as they drift from God's laws, their lives really become oftentimes a wretched mess. But they don't recognize that. I had a priest friend once, and I asked him, I said, what for you is the biggest reason to believe in God? He said to me, the system works. I said, what system? Liturgical system? What are you talking about? He said, the moral system. He said, the way God says to do it sexually, the way he says to do it morally, lovingly, is counterintuitive. It goes against what fallen human nature wants to do. It goes against, many times, what psychology says is the best way to live. And what happens is the system works. For maximum contentment and peace on this earth, do it God's way. And Humanae Vitae is probably the biggest thing in our culture that goes against the way the culture says to seek happiness.
So with Humane Vitae, 50 years now, the was it just sitting on a shelf gathering dust? Are we bringing something out that's been hidden, or is it making a real comeback here?
All great societal movements have occurred because of a determined minority. You can't mobilize a majority. It's very hard. When we declared independence from Britain, it was only a minority that wanted that.
Sure.
But they were determined. When we got rid of slavery, in its beginnings, it was just a minority that wanted that. The rest were kind of live and let live, and the other people said, yeah, this is what we want to do. Don't worry about it. When the apostles went out in their tiny little band, talk about a minority. So everything has been a minority. And the one thing Humana Vitae has on its side for people of a non-religious worldview is scientific fact. Now, I'm amazed at how many people can ignore science, especially those whose ideology collides with science. But we have science. We have reality. Even stripped of its morality, you can say biology has told us this is a human being. Biology has now told us this is a unique genetic makeup. Biology has now told us that there is a heartbeat prior to the fact that most women even know they're pregnant. Biology has shown us in 3D this picture of a human being. So the strict, rigid ideologues who say God doesn't exist, or if he does exist, I can ignore him because he thinks like me, we won't change them. No amount of science is going to change them. But there will be those people who will say, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. I have 10 adopted kids, Bob. And people will say to us, well, what do you tell the kids about their birth parents? And what do you emphasize? And I tell them, my kids, all 10 of them, are virulently pro-life because they know that their birth mothers probably went against their whole world to give them life. They were in high-risk situations. They were drug and alcohol exposed. They were oftentimes removed from the birth mother later in life. But the birth parents, somehow, some way, and I tell this to all the pro-life people, I said, you don't understand. Something made those birth mothers give birth to these children in situations where probably the vast majority, if not everybody in their lives, said, take care of the problem. And they gave birth to my children.
You know, I still remember, you talk about the science, how we embrace science, and science just sits out there. I still remember it was a few years ago, it was a Harvard Medical School professor or a medical doctor from Harvard, and he went to an African nation that was preaching with a tremendous AIDS problem, that was preaching abstinence, and he is an atheist. This guy was an atheist, and just went to study everything, and was a big proponent of condoms and safe sex and all the rest to cut back on AIDS, and then wrote a paper concluding, by golly, the scientific fact is abstinence dramatically lowered the rate of transmission, and the other didn't, you know, and was stunned, you know, but had to admit the truth.
Well, and here's a bright guy. Okay, this is a really bright guy. And it shows you how much he had swallowed the cliche thinking. He didn't even bother to think it through himself logically. He had to be hit with a sociological 2x4 before he finally said, oh my, maybe these Christian radicals have stumbled upon at least some truth. I remember a survey done, Bob. This is fascinating. It shows you the triumph of ideology over science. It shows you hypocrisy. 800, it was a conference of 800 what you would call sexologists, okay, people who studied sexual patterns. They asked them, if your partner were HIV positive and you knew it, would you have relations if there was a condom involved? How many do you think said they would? Yes.
Oh, man. Very low.
Zero.
Yeah.
Now think about this. These are the same people who are telling everyone else, well, this is what you need to do. You need to use this kind of protection. Yeah. Would you use it? No. Not where I'm concerned. Where those other people are concerned, yes, I have compassion. This is what they need to do. See the flaming hypocrisy, but it's there.
That's a stunning figure, but it's when you actually think about it, you just know that's going to be everybody's answer when it comes to, would you personally? Absolutely not.
Yeah, where I'm concerned, no. Where you're concerned, well, let me tell you how to do it.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Ray, a lot of people looking forward to your appearance in Southern California. It's going to be a huge conference, and hopefully a very meaningful conference that people will go back to their home parishes, their cities, and dioceses, and spread the good word of Humanae Vitae. And thanks so much for all you do, and thanks especially for joining us today.
Bob, I'm looking forward to coming out there and seeing you folks.
Very good. Well, safe journey. We're looking forward to it, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, God bless. That's Dr. Ray Guarendi, well-known and media guy as well, but also has that DR in front of his name, which gives him a little extra cachet. Well, here live and in person, Chris Owens, the new director of the Office of Family and Faith Formation, the OFFFFFFFF.
Yes, it's been kind of a joke around the office. Now we've got the former office, the Department of Evangelization and Catechesis,
right.
which is now divided into two offices, the UFFFF and Oh Yeah, which maybe has a nicer ring to it. So Deacon Kevin is remaining on board as the director of the Oh Yeah office. And then I've started as of the 1st of July for this new office for family and faith formation.
Well, yeah, it's, I finally, after all these years, had learned to spell evangelization and catechesis, and now it no longer. We are still doing evangelization and catechesis, but we don't have a department with that name.
But yeah, it's really interesting. I think in my reflections in coming on and what will this mean, coming a part of a really well established set of ministries in the diocese, and Deacon Kevin and I have chatted many times over the past weeks, and it seems like it's really an opportunity to do evangelization and catechesis, but in a more deep and targeted and specific way.
Mm-hmm.
So now evangelization and catechesis, of course, is something that is a part of the mission of everybody. But now I think with this reformation, we're going to be able to reach the people in the diocese in a much more specific way, in a more focused way. And I'm really excited about being a part of the team here.
So the old Office of Evangelization and Catechesis, which Kevin Stasko headed, Deacon Kevin Stasko, as of a couple of weeks ago, it encompassed a number of ministries, a number of areas. Is this just a straight split down the middle, or have new things been added on either side?
I see, yeah. I'd say for now, what's merely happened is a change in the structure.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who aren't aware, the Department of Evangelization and Catechesis covered everything from running the camps to marriage preparation, mm-hmm. to formation for certifications for catechists and for teachers in the schools, to you name it, everything kind of fell into this one department, and got to be, the office is pretty big. There's 14 yeah. people working here, and how do you have a meaningful office meeting? Sometimes we need to break up into groups and to work on only what we're focused on right now.
Sure.
So I think that's been one of the things that talking to the staff is they're really excited about is it's the same mission, the same people, and yet now we're going to be doing it maybe in a way that we actually increase collaboration rather than decrease collaboration. So it's a big thing that we still want to encourage is, of course, for instance, to take one is since you're talking about Humane Vitae
right.
just now is with the 50th anniversary is well the Office of Faith and Family and Faith Formation will still continue with all of the marriage preparation and
right.
with the promotion of life activities, and of course Youth and Young Adult Ministries, another office, is where the Newman Centers are
uh-huh.
And things, and so this is actually an opportunity to increase collaboration with the two new offices, because of course life issues aren't only
sure.
In one side. We were actually talking yesterday about how to get the word out to the Newman Centers about upcoming Respect Life Retreat mm-hmm. Day at the end of August. So I think it's going to create opportunities for collaboration rather than decrease them.
So the big question, though, is in which office is the Knights of Columbus pancake feeds after Sunday Mass?
They haven't told me that yet, but it sounds like something I need to put at the top of my priority list for the day, actually.
Indeed. Well, it's just I have a stack of various announcements, which I'll get to some of them today, some of them I won't. But it's just, it's mind-boggling to me. We're talking about the Humane Vitae conference coming up at the end of the month. Baseball, beer, Bishop Soto at Raleigh Field. Ministry days. You just go through it. The Respect Life conference coming up in August. On and on and on. The St. Vincent de Paul, and they're having a big picnic this weekend, and then they're having a comedy show, and just all these different ministries and all this stuff going on. I'm shocked you don't have, they didn't divide it into 16 parts.
Well, it's been very much an induction this past week. I feel as if I've had a large data dump into my brain, and now I'm kind of working slowly through sifting it and making sense of things myself. And I think a big part of it for me is just getting to know the people and the diocese. I mean, our diocese is 6.5 hours north of Sacramento, and you're still in the diocese.
Still in the diocese.
and so a big part of my first month here in the job is I'm going to be traveling around, and I'd like to meet with pastors, with DREs, with folks involved in marriage preparation, or with RCIA. The scope of the ministries, as you say, is kind of mind-boggling. And I think what we've been reflecting on as an office is how does our structure help to really support the ministries that are going on in the parishes, and how does this new creation of the offices create an opportunity for us to really take stock of who we are and where we're going. Of course, Bishop Soto has a pastoral plan that we're well advanced into the implementation of over many years, and so how does this reorganization help to not only check off a couple more things off the list, but to really get to the heart of the mission of the diocese and really support the local parish ministries and being a hub for information and also a place to come and just pick a brain on how to do something a little different, mm-hmm. how to maybe think about those ministries we've been doing for years in a new light. And so it really is, it's an exciting time here in the office.
We're talking with Chris Owens, the new director of the Office of Family and Faith Formation, as we call it, the OFFFFF. And the F's just kind of tail off, and then you put dot, dot, dot. And so I'm likening your experience right now, coming on board July the 1st, to like 6 weeks of boot camp. You're a new recruit, and it must be difficult, just as you say, just putting. It's one thing, you know, you're a new teacher and you got a classroom of students, and you begin to learn their names and who they are and meet their parents and stuff. But you've got one mission and it's one class and you're teaching them math or something in the fourth grade. Here, every new face you meet has a different role.
Yes.
So not only do you have to remember their name, he's in Catholic Charities. She's in this. Do you have flashcards? Do you go home and study them?
Well,
a little picture.
My fellow staff members here in the Pastoral Center have been really gracious in that regard. They'll prompt me and remind me. But it's been really great. The openness, I think, of all the departments here in the building. I've been able to just drop in and you know, they might have been working on something, but they stop what they're doing and really happy to take time and to tell me about themselves and about their office and about how the collaboration has worked historically and what opportunities they're really excited about for future collaboration. And of course, geographically, if you've ever been to the Pastoral Center, the schools department, is right across from our department, and we've just been talking about all the opportunities for collaboration, mm-hmm. there. Of course, Ministry Days is a big opportunity, right. where we come together, and then they're getting ready for a whole virtue-based approach with teaching throughout the whole schools, and so we been running across the hallway several times this week, just, you know, I had this idea, or, you know, this could really tie in well for the religious education, because, of course, what do you do in order to make sure that the quality of the education is consistent, even in places where people don't have access to Catholic schools, right. There's some challenges there, and also some solutions. So one of the things we've got a really well established deaf ministry,
right.
here in the diocese, but something that, as I'm talking with my regional coordinators for religious education, is comes up many times, is how do we offer catechesis for the sacraments for children with special needs,
mm-hmm.
and at least 9 or 10 parishes have come forward and looking for solutions, and I happened to mention it to the folks over in the schools department, and they were like, well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, and they were able to really give me a great insight into to some really great practices that they've found.
You know, and the schools have had to adapt to that, as we, you know, and some special, quote unquote, special needs kids. We have a special needs daughter. It's a wide spectrum.
Yes.
There's no stereotyping it. You
yes.
know, and one special needs kid's needs are remarkably different than another one's.
Yes.
And whether it's schools, whether it's, you know, sacramental preparation, or no matter what it is, each kid is really unique.
Yes.
Or even, you know, you're dealing with adults frequently. And it's a true challenge, but it's one that the church so willingly takes on.
Yes. And you know, I really think that, especially in the light of the reconfiguration of the offices, what we're talking about here is cultivating a culture of life,
right?
We think about this only with regard, maybe, typically to conception or death, but we're talking about a whole life sure. approach to the formation of the human person, and so I really think that this is the tip of the spear with regard to the new evangelization, right? John Paul II's new evangelization is if we lead with the family, if we lead with building faith communities, that's how we get strong parishes. That's how we grow right. as a diocese. That's how we're able to really promote an authentic Catholic faith, you know, in the modern world. This is just one example, but just many, many examples of conversations I've had this past week where people are just really enthusiastic. I mean, you can feel the movement of the Holy Spirit yeah. in this, and it's really it's infectious. I think.
Well, you know, it's yeah. interesting to me too, you know, there was a day 19 years ago when I was a newcomer here, and still sometimes you feel that way, but and we, for those that don't know, we broadcast from the Pastoral Center, so I'm surrounded by all these people, and it is remarkable to me. You think of the church, the 2,000-year-old church, and it's stayed and everything changes and all this stuff, and in this Pastoral Center, whether it's no matter what the ministry is, that everybody is striving to do better, to look for a better way. Like,
yes.
Like, no, we're not just going to keep doing it the same. And if people buy it, fine. If they don't buy it, fine. No, we're trying to reach out. As you say, we're all supposed to be evangelizing and catechizing. And we're yes. all supposed to be spreading the good word. And how can we do it better? And there's a lot of creative minds trying to do it better, but you know, we were talking about you and faces and what department are they in and all this. Well, I've been here 19 years, and there are people, I know there are people that avoid the radio. You know, they don't come down the hallway. they act engaged. You know, they don't, because they're a little nervous about being on the radio. And then the others that enjoy being on the radio, but there are people that you've been saying hi to for 2 or 3 years or 4 years, kind of like your next door neighbor, you know. But you maybe met them once and you don't know who they are.
Yes.
And then one day, there they are sitting across the aisle from you with my producer Gabe knows this well. I'm going, what's their name? I can't ask them their name. We've been saying hi for 4 years, but that's true. In the building, there are so many people working so hard.
Yes,
you know, and you know, you've been saying hi for a week now, Chris. You got to know my name.
Yes, exactly.
It is Chris.
You're Bob, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, maybe this is really where we in the beginning of the new millennium, Pope John Paul II wrote an encyclical, very famous now as an evangelization document, and he actually addresses this. He says, you know, for all of our pastoral plans, for all of our working to get to better the mission of the church, he says, you know, we need to stop and we need to remember the primacy of grace and how it works in and yeah. through our human institutions. And I just maybe share one anecdote from my own life experience where maybe a failure, quote unquote, in a pastoral plan was really intrinsic to my own Catholic faith, and that was, it was the summer month, and I'm a convert, so I wasn't yet a Catholic. I was sitting in the Mass, listening, and I was sitting there thinking, you know, this is really great. There's something about this Mass thing that really resonates with me, and I don't really know what that is, but as I was sitting there thinking about this, a desperate usher approached me because I guess the scheduling hadn't quite worked out for the summer Mass schedule for passing around the offering basket. And And he approached me, and he's like, you know, we really need some help. Can you come help and pass around the basket?
That's when I tell him I got a bad knee.
Right. Well, and I was sort of sitting there thinking like about whether or not I was going to become a Catholic, whether or not I wanted to take the next step and start the RCIA program. And here this desperate usher just came up, and he's like, you know, we really need you. We really need your help.
And I'd
been there enough times that I kind of knew the very complex pattern.
You think deacons, they spend 5 years. These guys, they collect in the, it's a 10-year program.
Oh, they're professionals. And so I got up and I helped with passing the offering basket around. And that was really, it struck me in a very profound way in that moment that that God was saying, Chris, whether it's something as small as passing around the offering basket, I really need you to do something for me and the church. And this really solidified it for me amongst a lot of other things that had been happening in my life as a young 20-something.
That's a great story.
So I really think that's it. It is grace works through all of our ministries, no matter how big or small, and that's when you can see God's plan unfolding is through all the little things that happen.
I think it's either in the Catechism or the Code of Canon Law that if you're not Catholic, you cannot receive Holy Communion, but you can take up the collection.
Yes, maybe.
You can even put money in the basket.
I think actually that was one of the essential canons that I had to learn about when I was doing my theology education.
That's just great. Well, Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a young man.
Sure. So I'm originally from the South. I'm from North Carolina.
Oh my goodness! What town?
From just outside of Raleigh.
Uh-huh.
So they've just gotten a new bishop there recently, and they've built a new cathedral. Mm-hmm. It just goes to show, I think, the growth of the Catholic Church in the southeastern part of the United States,
which has traditionally been very low,
very low, and in the Bible Belt, maybe even anti-Catholic at times. So the church has been growing there quite a lot, and my whole life I lived in North Carolina until I was 23, after I converted to Catholicism. I actually traveled overseas, and I lived in Scotland for a year, working in youth ministry and evangelization.
You know, when we first met, I said, "There's something in the British Isles in this voice," but no, I think he's an American. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Back and forth, but they're just. I remember spending like 3 weeks in Scotland, and coming back, and you just, there's little phrases, little ways of, it doesn't take long before you're mimicking what you've just heard.
Yes, indeed. And when I found, after moving back to America, after I lived 3 years, so I lived in Scotland for a year and then England for 2 years. And I actually met my wife in England, although she's from Minnesota.
And they speak all together differently.
Oh yeah, all for you betcha. But I found my cadence, the words I used, the inflections I gave to words, it just changed entirely, and it was really a culture shock actually coming back to America. Took a position as a director of religious education in Wyoming, which is, of all places, in the last of the Old West, Jackson Hole.
Jackson Hole. But my wife's from Wyoming.
Okay,
and I've told people that it is the Wild West. It's still the Wild West. It's very, very remotely populated, and it is stunningly beautiful.
Yes,
and wild.
It really is. Where I was living there is about 2 hours south of Yellowstone, mm-hmm. and I remember one morning I was walking out of the house. It was the early winter. The first snows had come down, and we were living on a ranch that was in the shadow of the Tetons.
Oh, man.
And I was on my way to work, but I'd come out of our apartment, which was nearby a horse barn on the property of, from our landlords, and there was a moose eating hay right outside of my door.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I had to just back very slowly back in and close the door because they'll rear up. And
yeah.
Yeah. So, Wyoming is a very, very rural area, right? The parish where I was working, the next nearest parish was about an hour and 15 minutes away. And that was a mission of the one where I was working at. So the priests went down every Sunday for Mass, and the next nearest parish outside of ours was about 2 hours away. So so it would actually really, I think, prepared me for coming to Sacramento eventually. Of course, with the North State, it's quite rural.
Yeah. And a lot of similarities. You get especially the Northeast part. My wife and I have said this before. I've said when you're up near Alturas in that area, you could tell me I was in Wyoming. I'd believe it.
Yes,
the sagebrush and the high country and the the kind of the starkness of the landscape.
Yes, and so that's quite a different set of pastoral needs than the urban or metropolitan area around Sacramento.
Yeah.
And so I'm really looking forward to going up to the North State, actually. I was speaking with Hector, who's in the North State office of the diocese, and we're going to put together a tour probably at the end of July, the beginning of August, for me to go spend 3 days up there.
Well, what I remember about Jackson Hole, Wyoming, is you talk about moose. There's this one square in the town where there's just antlers.
Oh, yes.
Everywhere.
Oh, yes.
Our kids looked at that and said, "Whoa, wow."
Well, and the town is really collaborative, and the Boy Scouts go out and they pick up the antlers, and then they do an auction in order to raise money. So it's quite an exciting festival they have every spring when the snow finally melts.
But if you did not believe in God before you saw the Grand Tetons, you would afterwards.
It's
magnificent.
True. It really is true. And there's a beautiful chapel in Grand Teton National Park, the Chapel of the Sacred Heart. And it's right next to the lake. And they have Mass there. They work really hard to bring in priests, actually, who'll come maybe do vacation time in the area. And they'll get a schedule of priests through the summer months. Maybe one of the advantages of being a local is when I was in the parish, we did a confirmation retreat in the chapel in the middle of the winter.
They have Mass year round.
No.
Oh, okay.
You can't get into the park. There's 15 or 18 feet of snow
in
some places.
You need a snowmobile.
But where the chapel was, we were able to get in there the late part of the winter, and we trekked through and we dug up a hole through 4 feet of snow to get to the chapel, and it was a really great confirmation retreat with our young people there that spring.
That's wonderful. And of course, Wyoming has the Catholic College.
Yeah, they
which,
do.
Who knew that would happen in Lander, I think.
Yeah, Lander, just on the other side of the mountain range. Yeah. And they would come over and they would do their winter camping in Jackson Hole and stay in the parish. And they would stay overnight in an igloo they would build. And they would go out trekking, cross-country skiing. And some really great things going on in the diocese at large. Of course, the Carmelites, the mystic monks who roast their own coffee, are up near Cody.
Right.
Just
one diocese in Wyoming.
Yeah, just one diocese in the whole of Wyoming. Of course, the bishop is in Cheyenne in Wyoming, which is 7.5 hours away from the parish where I was at. But really great things going on there as far as a revival in their ministries as well. Their youth ministries have really been strong, and their faith formation also has different challenges, as I said, because it's so rural. But I've been really impressed with my time there. Of course, I didn't immediately come to California from Wyoming after my first son Benedict was born. we decided that it was time for me to go back to school and finish my education. And when we were looking around at options, of course, to support a family as a full-time student is quite difficult. So we decided to pick up and move back to Europe. Mm-hmm. We went to Austria to the International Theological Institute, which is just outside of Vienna. Mm-hmm. Under the patronage of Cardinal Schönborn, of course, who edited the Catechism.
Sure.
So we were there for nearly 4 years before we moved to Rome, where I did my studies for my license in theology and my residence for my doctorate at the Angelicum. So we've been kind of world travelers in a certain sense. While we were back in Europe the second time, we had two more children, Leo and Anthony, and we've moved to California just a year ago after I finished my studies, and living here in Sacramento, and really excited. We just had our first daughter, actually. Miriam was born in April, so.
You couldn't name her after a pope.
Well, you know, I think there was in the history of the church somebody who had claimed the papacy, a Pope Joan or something. Yeah. But this is very, very deep medieval history.
I could be wrong, but I think it was a former bishop from Cheyenne, the whole diocese of Wyoming, who was reassigned to Anchorage. And said, "Oh, good! I'm going to a warmer climate."
Yes, that's right. Bishop Aitchen.
Is that right?
Yeah. Now Archbishop. In fact, now he actually is a really important person in the U.S. bishops. He is, I believe, he's still the director for the National Rural Life Conference.
Oh, sure.
And that association,
so important.
Of Catholics and. But really a great man. Just every time I had the opportunity to meet him, I always walked away feeling as if I'd learned something, profound reflection on how the Eucharist brings people together, even over a very large geographic area. And so maybe Wyoming was a good preparation for his new assignment up there. Of course, there's also a previous bishop there, Bishop Ricken, mm-hmm. who's now in Green Bay. Seems to be like a good proving ground for good bishops. This has actually been kind of the consternation maybe of some of the folks who would like the good bishop to stay around a little while.
Yeah.
But from what I hear, their new bishop that they've just received after Bishop Aitchen went up to Alaska, Bishop Stephen is really a good man, very caring man. He's also local. He's from just across the border in South Dakota. So,
oh, very good. And then Bishop Supich, who was in South Dakota.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. There's a whole little Midwest
now
network.
Chicago, yeah.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes. And it may be in a similar way here in California. Yeah. A good network of bishops who know each other and are able to collaborate very well together as a result.
Oh my goodness! In Philadelphia,
Chaput,
in Denver, and
yes.
Native American, and et cetera, and knows the Wild West well as well.
Yes, and then also Bishop Conley was the auxiliary bishop in Denver before going to Lincoln, Nebraska, and I actually when. It was funny when Archbishop Chaput went to Philadelphia. I was having conversations with friends. I said, "You know, I bet you Bishop Aquila from Fargo is going to get sent to Denver." And sure enough, he was.
I remember following Bishop Aquila when he was in Fargo. Just a pro-life stalwart, and in a great pro-life state, but just in thing, this is a real man of God.
Yes, and for catechesis, coming back into what I'm doing here in the diocese, while he was in Fargo, they had a really and they continue to have an excellent catechesis department, and they set some standards nationally. I mean, their diocesan catechetical manual that was produced while Bishop Kokula was there it's a good, if you were to print it off, it's 2.5-3 feet tall.
Wow.
And so they've got a really well developed program that's a long tradition now, more than a decade, maybe two decades pushing. And so I think, you know, you follow the movements of the bishops. It's not just for ecclesial sort of gossip or politics. There's a real practical application to it,
sure.
in the sense of you see where bishops are implementing best practices, and I'd say again here in California in a similar way. We have Bishop Soto here, of course, but he's from Southern California, you've got Archbishop Gomez, and now Auxiliary
right.
Bishop Barron, great supporter of the new evangelization, and then all throughout the Bay Area, Oakland. And San Francisco and Santa Rosa, just a lot of really great bishops. When you've got a good, strong conference inside of a state like that, it only trickles down.
And Bishop Cotta, who's a son of the Valley,
is now
in Stockton. Grew up
you had him on the radio just before he left.
And of course, Bishop Vasha was up in the eastern Oregon, very similar Northern California, parts of it.
Yes.
And now in Santa Rosa. And I remember interviewing him one time when he was still in the Diocese of Baker, and just thinking, again, what a great man, what a holy man.
Yes. And with that, I think there's an attraction for vocations.
Yeah.
Right? You see the holiness is inspiring, and you see that there's young men who encountering their parish priest, who are encountering their local bishop as he comes around for his visits, and I think that holiness inspires, it attracts,
and this is the
renewal of the vocations to the priesthood. Of course, that really starts at a young age, though. I mean, this is, I think, the importance of our office, to see that relationship between family and catechesis, because it starts, from the day a child's born or before a child's born, in praying for their will, for God's will in their life, and then surrounding them with a household of prayer, supported by a community of prayer and the sacraments. And So it's really exciting to come out here to California, where so much is happening, and to be a part of this great renewal we've got going on here.
Chris, it's an honor to have you here, and I know great things are going to happen, so God bless your work, and we'll look forward to talking to you again frequently.
Oh, sure. I'll look forward, especially I'm right across the hallway. If you ever need, 10 minutes to fill, I'm happy to come on and have a chat. So,
very good.
Yeah.
Thanks,
all right.
Chris.
Thank you so much, Bob.
This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of America, Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley and Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley and Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
This is Bishop William K. Wiegand, the Bishop Emeritus of Sacramento, and you're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Denning.